Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for February 6th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the genetics behind the black coats of North American gray wolves, the biochemistry of better short-term memory, and exploring the origin of art. All this and more, plus a roundup of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
We usually think that dogs develop from wolves, and the work shows that here's an example where dogs gave something back to wolves.
Greg Barsch is a geneticist at Stanford University. What the dogs gave back to wolves by mixing with them was their different coat colors. And pretty much any dog breed that can be black, Labradors, Great Danes, even poodles, share the mutation, or a variant of it, with North American gray wolves. In a paper published online by Science, Barsch and his colleagues describe that mutation, which also occurs in coyotes and Italian gray wolves. The results demonstrate that the traits we breed in dogs can influence the diversity of their wild relatives. Greg, what's the timeline here for when dogs and wolves split apart and got back together, as it were?
Sure. Well, previous work by several groups has a window for when dogs develop from wolves or split from wolves, say somewhere between, maybe 15,000 and 40,000 years ago is the estimates for, say, domestication of dogs from wolves. And there probably was, several events that took place over, a longer period of time. But the introduction of the dog black coat color mutation into wolves is more recent, sometime probably within the past 10,000 years, I think. It's interesting because if you think about how dogs first populated North America, there's really two routes for how the dog black coat color mutation could have been introduced into North American wolves. One is from Native American dogs who, were here with Native Americans, say, 10,000 years ago. And then the other is from European dogs who obviously entered North America sometime in the last, say, 400 or 500 years.
And this K black mutation, that's what the dogs gave back. What does that do in the wolves?
This is a gene that was recognized by our lab just last year to cause black coat color in dogs. It does the same thing in wolves that it does in dogs. It's dominantly inherited. So if you're an animal that is homozygous for that mutation, then you will pass that on to all of your progeny. If you're heterozygous for the mutation, then, half of your litter will carry the black mutation and half of them won't. And we use the word mutation because it's derived the ancestral form of the allele, the form that, say, exists in all other mammals, including humans, gives rise to a gray or sometimes a yellow coat color. We call it yellow because that's how we recognize it in dogs, but in wolves, it's associated with the phenotype we usually think about in wolves, the sort of classic North American gray wolf.
What are the dog breeds that have the mutation and so may have, or their ancestor may have, mated with the
wolves?
Yeah,
that's a great question. So just about any dog breed where you see a completely black coat color in some members of that breed carries the black mutation. So that would include black Labradors, black Shepherds, black Great Danes, and black Poodles. It's widely spread through a very diverse group of dog breeds. The only exception that I know of is actually in German Shepherds, which is kind of ironic because usually when we think of German Shepherds, we think of this sort of brushed, typical kind of, brownish appearance or golden appearance. But German Shepherds occasionally come in black. And that's actually not due to the mutation that causes black in wolves, but is due to a much less frequent mutation that can also cause a black coat that's recessively inherited.
Now, is this kind of thing still going on, that dogs are still mating with wolves, say, like in the famous book by Jack London, Call of the Wild, where Buck, a dog, becomes an alpha male in a wolf pack?
Boy, you've stimulated me to pick up my old Jack London books again. In fact, it is happening, and in particular, it's happening in areas of the world where the environmental conditions favor dog-wolf mating. And that's exactly, in fact, what we talk about this in the paper. That's what's happened quite recently, we think, in Italy, where wolves were hunted almost to extinction. There's a very small founder population, and then because of sort of the economic and environmental conditions, there's a huge expansion of actually the wild dog population. So in certain regions of Italy, wild dogs outnumber wolves something like, 100 to 1. So there's a constant and consistent wolf-dog hybridization in those areas. It's much less frequent in North America. You know, we think that the donation of the dog black gene to the wolves in Yellowstone and in North America was a rare event that happened, as I said, hundreds or thousands of years ago. It was very infrequent.
So the traits that we're selecting for now in breeding dogs may be making their way into the wolf population.
Oh, absolutely. And also, there's a community of canine fanciers who like to breed dogs and wolves. And, you can debate about whether that's a good or a bad thing. But, certainly in both unsupervised situations and in supervised situations, there are examples where exactly what you said takes place. That is, the traits that we selected for in different dog breeds are making their way into wolves.
Does the molecular and evolutionary history of this introduction of this K-black gene into dogs and into wolves have any broader implications for human genetics? Dogs share similar diseases with humans and appear to be becoming the geneticist's best friend.
Well, yeah, I think dogs are certainly a very good friend of the geneticist. I think the jury is still out on whether dog genetics are going to tell us more about humans or tell us more about biology in general. I think they're certainly going to tell us a tremendous amount of biology in general. The nature of the gene is pretty intriguing, and that's because it's not a great candidate. It's not something that you would think of as a coat color gene, not something that causes changes in hair color, skin color, eye color in any other animal that's been looked at so far. Instead, this gene, the dog coat color gene, and now the wolf black coat color gene, which we call the K locus, is a kind of a protein called beta defensin, which is a small secreted molecule that is named defensin because it's thought to play a part in defending against environmental or infectious insults, part of the innate immune system.
Is that the advantage that the black coat color gene would confer in wolves, or is it more about the ability of the wolf to sort of fit in with its environment?
I don't know. I think that's just a really fascinating question. It is sort of intuitively appealing when you see animals that blend in with their environment to say, oh, well, that explains the natural selection, that somehow they are better camouflaged either as predator or prey. There's two reasons to think that might not be the case for black wolves. The first is because wolves don't have a lot of, predators, I guess, other than humans. And it's a little bit difficult to think that, the black coat color mutation protects them from humans. And there's no evidence to date to suggest that differences in wolf, say, gray versus black wolf coat color lead to any increase in the ability of a wolf to capture its prey. The second reason is because people are fascinated by wolves, and they've followed them and photographed them for now, decades. And black wolves are a little bit like humans. They turn gray with age. And so you would think that if the black coat color mutation was being selected for specifically because it caused a black coat color, that you wouldn't get these, older gray wolves, that they would stay black. So we really don't know exactly what the selective advantage is. It does seem pretty clear that there is a selective advantage because we find black wolves in many areas of North America that are forested but don't see them in areas that are open, and so that does fit in with the camouflage idea. But it is intriguing to think that, like several other genes in the pigmentary system, that the value of this gene to the wolves is not via its effect on pigmentation, but some other biological process.
Well, Greg Barsch, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Greg Barsch is senior author of a paper on the molecular and evolutionary history of melanism in North American gray wolves. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Now with a policy update, here's Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Climate change will continue to be a major issue in the foreseeable future, with new President Barack Obama and a tight-knit group of Democrats in Congress ready to take it on. It also continues to be the favorite issue of former Vice President Al Gore, who was responsible for the 2006 documentary An Inconvenient Truth. Gore returned to his congressional roots last week when he testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He cited scientific projections that temperature rises will impact all facets of life around the globe within this century. He called global warming an urgent and unprecedented threat to the existence of civilization. To attack this problem, Gore urged Congress to pass President Obama's economic stimulus package, which contains investments in energy efficiency, renewable energy, and cleaner cars. And he called for legislation that would create a federal cap-and-trade system to limit carbon dioxide emissions. Even if carbon emissions were to be completely stopped, an article from Susan Solomon at NOAA and international colleagues concludes that damage to the Earth will be essentially irreversible. Depending on the maximum atmospheric carbon dioxide level at the time when emissions are halted, dry season conditions like the Dust Bowl of the 1930s will be found in some regions. The sea level rise could be on the order of meters, with dire effects on small islands and low-lying coastal regions. The authors caution that no one should be fooled by the fact that the process of climate change has been slow. The damage will be felt for at least 1,000 years. The paper was published last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Can you remember these numbers and repeat them back? 1-3-5-6-2-8-4-9. The question, and answering it, 1-3-5-6-2-8-4-9, is an example of training your short-term or working memory. In a paper in this week's Science, Torkel Klingberg and colleagues report that training the working memory is associated with changes in the brain's dopamine system. The research may have implications for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, schizophrenia, and those who suffer deficits in short-term memory from the normal process of aging. I spoke with Klingberg from his office at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden.
What we found was that when people do cognitive training, this changes the dopamine receptors in the brain. And this means that the basic biochemistry of the brain is affected by our cognition. On a more general level, I think these results show that the interaction between mental activity and biochemistry is more complex than we thought. We knew that, like, your mood and your cognitive abilities are affected by the biochemistry of the brain. But now we can see that the mental activity also affects the biochemistry of the brain. So it goes both ways here, and this makes it more complex to think about cause and effect when you look at receptor studies in the future.
What type of training are you having your participants do?
We're using working memory training, and this is a method we developed previously in order to enhance working memory capacity, and it's useful for persons with attention deficits. But in this study, we're not using it for ADHD. We're more using it as a method to study the effect of cognition on the brain, in a way to experimentally have participants doing a specific cognitive training.
Now, by working memory, this is also short-term memory, or the ability to remember information for a short period of time? Is that right?
Yeah. Working memory is the ability to retain information for a short period of time. For example, remembering what you're about to do next, or keeping relevant information in mind while you solve a problem.
What's going on in the brain when people have normal, healthy working memory?
Well, we know that many systems are important for working memory. The prefrontal cortex, the parietal cortex, and we also know that the dopamine system is important for working memory. Either too much or too little is not good. So you have to have the just right amount of dopamine transmission to have an optimum working memory.
So in your study, who were your participants and how did they train their working memory?
We had young, healthy adults participating in this study, and they were given this working memory training program. So they perform working memory tasks repeatedly for about half an hour a day for 5 days a week for 5 weeks.
And as a result, what happened in their brains, or what was associated with what happened in their brains?
Yeah, we measure working memory capacity before and after training, and we could see that they have enhanced the working memory capacity.
They got better.
Yeah, better. They can store more information. And this is consistent with our previous behavioral studies. Now, we measured both dopamine D1 and D2 receptors in the brain with positron emission tomography before and after training. And then what we did was to use an MR scanner to find out which part of the brain are involved in working memory. So that by identifying these, we have a region, we identified regions of interest. And then we looked specifically in those regions of interest if anything happened to the dopamine system. And what we found was that for D2 receptors, there was no association. But for D1 receptor, we found this correlation between how much they improved from training and changes in D1 receptor density.
So using the positron emission tomography and the MRI or magnetic resonance imaging, you found that there was an associated difference in density in the dopamine receptors, D1 receptors. Is it more receptors? I guess we would think that there would be more receptors would be better for memory, but was that the case?
No, the relationship between performance, working memory performance, and dopamine density is a very complex one, and it seems to be nonlinear. So either too much or too little is not good. You need just the right amount. And for most of these subjects, it was actually a decrease in receptor density associated with performance of training, while for some of them, there was a small increase. But all of this was correlated to how much they improved.
Now, you mentioned that this research was also associated with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Are the results in this study consistent with the reduced working memory for those with this type of disorder or other psychiatric or neurological disorders, or even indeed the normal aging process?
I think it has implications for many patient groups. We know that working memory deficits occur, for example, in ADHD, where they are an important part of their behavioral problems. We know that you have problems with working memory in aging, and you have deficits in working memory also in schizophrenia. And in all these three categories, it has been associated with the dopamine system. So it's very interesting to see that this type of cognitive training also includes and affects the dopamine system. And perhaps if we learn more about what's happening in the brain when we are training the brain, we could improve these methods for cognitive training and perhaps also combine in the future cognitive training with pharmacological interventions.
Is that going to be your team's next step, or are you going to be looking perhaps at why the dopamine receptors' densities change?
We don't know the mechanisms underlying this signal change that we see. It could be a reaction to the fact that working memory training increases the endogenous release of dopamine during several weeks, and then the receptors react to that and go from the membrane to the internal part of the cell as a reaction to this. But it does show that working memory training involves the dopamine system, and we're very interested in continuing this, perhaps to look at combinations of pharmacological agents that affect the dopamine system and how that would interact with cognitive training.
Torkel Klingberg, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Torkel Klingberg is senior author of a paper on the link between brain chemistry and behavior. Read the paper in this week's Science. The year 2009 marks the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin and the 150th anniversary of the publication of his famous book, On the Origin of Species. To commemorate these occasions, Science is presenting a special series that takes a broad look at key developments in evolution and in human culture. In this installment, Science contributing correspondent Michael Balter writes on the origin of art. I spoke with him from his office in Paris.
I have been writing so much about the quote-unquote earliest art, which nobody could agree about what the earliest art was, and it seemed like a hopeless quest because always somebody was coming up with art that was even earlier. So what I decided to focus on was other indications of symbolic behavior that were not so much directly related to art, but involved some of the same cognitive capacities that art would also require. On the assumption that if you're capable of symbolic behavior, then you're almost kind of automatically capable of engaging in artistic expression. And so I focused on indications in the archaeological record that appeared to be relevant to that. One was tool manufacture. Another was the appearance of ochre pigments in the archaeological record, which a lot of archaeologists have proposed were used in symbolic ways. And these are the kinds of things that I looked at in the essay.
At what point or what early artwork do people agree that, yep, this is art, hands down, nobody's saying otherwise?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I think that everybody will agree that the Chauvet Cave, for example, in France, which is the oldest known cave painting, it's dated to about 32,000 radiocarbon years. If you calibrate that into real calendar years, probably is going to come out to about 36,000 to 37,000 years ago. You've got lions, you've got horses and bison and so forth, that's clearly real art. I mean, some of it is really as good as anything anybody could do today. Where you start getting into problems is when you start going back further, for example, to a site like Blombos Cave in South Africa, where you've got pieces of ochre etched in cross-hatched patterns. Now, there's no question that the ochre was etched that way, and that there's no question that the dating is right, about 75,000, 77,000, and now we even got some of that back to 100,000 years ago. So is that art? Well, there people start disagreeing. Is it really art? Is it just doodling? Did they etch it for some other utilitarian purpose, like they were trying to get some extra ochre out of it? So you've really got a problem the further back you start to push it. So I think that it would probably be fair to say that anything earlier than 40,000 years ago, you're going to have an argument about. And I think that that's the reason why we need to kind of go back to basics.
The basics, then, are tool manufacture and ochre, or the creation of pigments? How so?
Well, what I refer to them in the essay, I refer to them as sort of proxy indicators. Now, let's take tool making as the first example. A lot of archaeologists would argue that at a certain point in human tool making, the very earliest known tools are about 2.6 million years old. They were found in Ethiopia. They're very simple. They're the kind of thing, actually, that you can teach a chimp to do. You basically strike two rocks together. You throw a rock against the wall, or you hit a rock with some other object, and you can make a piece of it fall off, which you could then, you know, sharpen a little bit, and lo and behold, you've got kind of a scraper, or you've got something that could possibly be used to cut plants and things like that, or butcher an animal. That doesn't really appear to require a great deal of cognitive ability, a great deal of sort of keeping an image in your mind, which is what symbolism is really all about. But later on in the history of toolmaking, say around 500,000 years ago, you begin to get very highly symmetrical objects called hand axes. And the later versions of these, several hundred thousand years old, are really quite symmetrical. And most archaeologists agree that to make such a tool, you had to have had the idea ahead of time in your mind. Then you've got a piece of stone, and you impose this abstract form on the piece of stone by chipping away at it until it looks like your preconceived notion.
Symmetry, then, being the important component to say, this actually is something other than just sort of that chipped rock thrown against the wall.
Right, because to make a symmetrical object, you really have to have a sense of symmetry in your mind ahead of time. And then you've got to make that stone look like the image that's in your head. And that's an activity that is considered by most to be analogous to symbolism.
What about the ochre, the pigment you were talking about before?
Well, there again, we have this sort of perennial problem. The further back you go in time, the more people are going to disagree about the interpretation. In Upper Paleolithic Europe, for example, European sites that were clearly inhabited by modern humans up to about 40,000 years ago, anytime you find pieces of ochre that's been sprinkled on burials, archaeologists tend to assume that that is clear evidence of symbolic behavior, that there's being some kind of ritual activity that's associated with the burial. Another assumption, based on kind of what people, some hunter-gatherer tribes still do today, is that the ochre might have been used to paint bodies, sort of a personal identification, and that is considered to be ritualistic or symbolic behavior as well, sort of by definition. The problem is that when you go back to earlier and earlier sites where you find ochre, there becomes more and more of an argument as to how the ochre was used. So let's go back to Blombos Cave again in South Africa. There, if you leave aside the etching on the ochre and you just look at the fact that there's a great deal of ochre has been found at that site, we don't know how it was used other than possibly for etching. We don't know whether it was perhaps used for personal adornment or whether it might have been put to some utilitarian uses. For example, experiments by modern archaeologists have shown that ochre is very, very good for hafting a stone tool into a handle made of wood or bone. It's a very good adhesive. So again, you know, the further you go back in the archaeological record, the further you go back in time, the more arguments you have.
Overall, why all the debate? The science and archaeology aside, why is it so important to pin down the origin of art?
Well, I would argue that it's not so important to pin down the origin of art, that what's more important is to pin down the origins of symbolism. Once you're capable of symbolic behavior, you're kind of capable of a whole lot of behaviors. You're capable of language. You know, you and I couldn't be having this conversation were we not able to assign meanings to words, and meanings that have no relationship to the actual form of the word itself. I mean, take the word word. That's just a very arbitrary way of indicating a particular meaning that you and I have agreed to. But if you and I were French, we would use a different word, the word mot, to refer to the exact same concept. So rather than looking for the earliest art, the trick is to look for the earliest signs of symbolism. And the way to do that primarily is to find proxy activities, activities that are very well represented in the archaeological record, such as ochre, such as tool making, where we can therefore form certain hypotheses about whether they were used symbolically or not and test them out by what we find or what we can hope to find in the archaeological record.
Michael Balter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science contributing correspondent Michael Balter writes on the origin of art. You can follow the year-long Origins essay series and find other content about Darwin and evolution, including a special series of articles on speciation in this week's issue, at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how test tube babies can shed light on the nature versus nurture debate, how chocolate has a rich history in North America, and finally, how ancient turtles island hopped from Asia to North America.
Well, let's start off with that profound question, nature versus nurture. How do test tube babies help in addressing that question?
Well, Rob, as you know, the whole nature versus nurture debate is, do our genes control who we are, or does our environment control who we are? And this even holds true for the womb. There is a debate about whether our fetal environment, say the foods our mother eats or whether or not she smokes, can have the same profound effect on the type of person we turn out to be as the genes we inherit from our parents. And these questions are very difficult to sort out because how do you really go about separating the contribution of genes versus environment? And in this new study, researchers found a clever way to do that. And what they looked at is in vitro fertilization babies or test tube babies. And they're called that because the sperm and egg are actually joined together in the lab, and then the fertilized egg is implanted in a mother.
And usually mothers have their own eggs re-implanted back into their wombs.
But not always. Some mothers actually use the eggs of other mothers because perhaps they themselves are not fertile or for other reasons. And therefore, the fetus that they grow in their womb is not genetically related to them. And the researchers of this new study said, aha, that's a great way to be able to tease out these contributions of nature versus nurture or genes versus environment. And what this study looked at was the effect that mothers smoking while pregnant had on their child. And two factors they looked at was low birth weight. And researchers already have a pretty good idea idea that when mothers smoke, it causes chemical changes in the womb that cause the fetus to be born with a lower than average birth weight. And they're pretty sure that that is mainly an environmental issue. It's not related to genetics. So that was a good control for the study. And one other effect they looked at was antisocial behavior. There's been research to indicate that mothers who smoke tend to have kids that are more antisocial. That means they are more likely to throw tantrums or lie or things of that nature. But the link between smoking and antisocial behavior has been less clear. Is it because of the smoking, or is it because of something in the mother's genetics that's causing these children to be antisocial after they're born?
So having mothers who smoke with fetuses that are not genetically related to them is the perfect set of data.
Exactly. And what they found in this study is, as they suspected with the low birth rate, it didn't matter whether mothers carried fetuses that were genetically related to them or not. All of these kids tended to have lower than average birth weight. So that confirmed what researchers suspected already. But with the antisocial behavior, what they noticed is that mothers who were genetically related to their children were much more likely to have those children be antisocial when they smoked than mothers who weren't related to their fetuses. And that means that there is a genetic component to antisocial behavior.
Now, we said this was the perfect data set, but how many instances or how many data points do we actually have in making that kind of statement?
Well, that is one downside of the study. Even though the researchers looked at 800 in vitro fertilization births, only a very small fraction of those met the criteria that they were looking at in the study in terms of mothers that smoked and fetuses that were not genetically related. So ideally, you want to see a much bigger data set than this before you draw any hard conclusions. But at least this is a first step for future studies.
Well, from the origins of traits like antisocial behavior to the origins of chocolate in North America, what's the evidence in this story?
Well, Rob, this story deals with a group of people known as the Anasazi, which were a Native American people. And this specific group of people that are being looked at in this study lived in a place called, appropriately, the Chaco Canyon, which is in northwestern New Mexico, about 1,000 years ago. And a group of archaeologists have been excavating some of their sites, and they found some unusual objects. They were these thin cylindrical vases that had these ornate blue-gray geometric patterns. You can actually see a picture of these on the site. And researchers puzzled for almost a decade about what their purpose was. And finally, one of the researchers realized that these vases look very similar to vases used by the Mayan people to drink chocolate. And the Mayan people would mix this chocolate with water, corn, and chili peppers and drink it during very special rituals, especially like rite of passage rituals. So it was very important to their culture. But the researchers were surprised to see the same kind of vases in North America because they didn't think chocolate had come to North America until European colonists had come to North America. And to test their hunch, what they did was they did a chemical analysis of these Anasazi vases. And what they found was that the vases tested positive for a chemical called theobromine, which is a telltale signature of chocolate. And so this confirmed the idea that these Anasazi people were drinking chocolate 1,000 years ago, much earlier than we thought chocolate had actually been brought to North America.
That's a really far distance for the chocolate to come.
Well, exactly. And the theory is that they must have been getting this chocolate from Central America. And archaeologists knew this trade route existed already. They knew that these people were trading back and forth very important items like copper bells and jewelry and other types of things like that. But the fact that chocolate also now seems to have been traded along this route suggests that chocolate had a very important purpose in the Anasazi culture as well. And some experts speculate that it was important as a fine wine or a brandy is for us today.
So a status symbol.
Exactly.
Well, from a long trade route for the Anasazi to a short migration route for Asian turtles coming to America, they island hopped over the Arctic.
Well, that's the surprising finding from this new study, Rob. And this study concerns a group of Asian turtles. And these turtles were thought to have come to North America about 100 to 65 million years ago. And this would have been over a land bridge that connected Russia to Alaska at the time. But it's kind of a long route. It's a bit circuitous, but it seemed like the most plausible route because the most direct route would have been over the Arctic Ocean, which researchers thought was, first of all, a saltwater ocean, and these turtles were freshwater. And also, that's a lot of water for turtles to cross. Turtles need at least a few places to stop and rest along the way. So it didn't seem like a very plausible route. But what happened in this new study was that researchers were doing some field work in the Canadian Arctic. And they specifically were on an island called Axel Heiberg Island, which is just west of northern Greenland. And they unearthed a turtle fossil. And what was special about this fossil was that it seemed very highly related to these Asian turtles I just mentioned. And what's more, it lacked webbed feet, which meant it was a freshwater turtle, just like these Asian turtles were. And dating revealed that the turtle was about 90 million years old.
At a time which the world was a different place.
Well, that's the idea. I mean, the location of the turtle would mean that somehow these Asian turtles took a much more direct route. Instead of doing this circuitous route from Asia to Russia, they cut across the Arctic Ocean.
Which is covered by ice today.
Exactly. It's covered by ice today. But upon further analysis, the researchers said that maybe this route makes sense because, you know, 100 million years ago, the Arctic was a much different place than it is today. There was, first of all, a lot of volcanoes in the area that were spewing massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And today we think of carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And it was back then too. And it actually caused a lot of global warming. And the area of the Arctic was actually 34 degrees Celsius warmer than it is today, which means its weather was much like that of northern Florida. So there wasn't all this ice for the turtles to cross.
And the volcanoes may have been above the water?
Well, that's the other idea, is that the volcanoes actually formed this ridge, which is called the Alpha Ridge, under the water. And because of the enormous heat of the volcanoes, the ridge actually lifted somewhat above the water. So parts of the ridge were actually sticking out above the water, creating essentially an archipelago whereby the turtles could island hop from Asia directly to North America. And what's more, because of the really warm weather, there was a lot of rain and a lot of river runoff in this area. And this river runoff was fresh water. So even though these were freshwater turtles, they could swim across a saltwater ocean because the top layer of the ocean was largely fresh water because of all this runoff. So some of this is still speculation, obviously, but this fossil find indicates that these turtles did take a direct route.
What further evidence would be needed to put this theory on more solid ground?
Well, one expert suggests that these researchers or future researchers drill on this Alpha Ridge to make sure it was actually volcanic, because it would really need to have been volcanic to create this archipelago. And finding more turtle fossils might help too.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a discovery of the smallest exoplanet found to date. And small exoplanets are really important because the smaller the planet is, the more likely it is to resemble Earth. So this is a potentially very exciting finding. And on the policy blog, we're continuing to follow this massive stimulus package that the U.S. Congress is trying to pass. And what's significant about this package is it includes billions of dollars for scientific research in the U.S., so it could have a really huge impact on science. And we're also following some bizarre news out of the National Science Foundation, where reports suggest that a senior official there has been spending a lot of his workday viewing pornography on the internet. And this is significant because it could potentially impact the type of funding that the National Science Foundation gets in the future. So be sure to check out the site.
I'll see you next week in Chicago, Dave.
Yeah, we'll be at the AAAS annual meeting and we'll be blogging from the meeting like we have done for the past couple years. And I understand you'll be doing some podcasts from the meeting as well.
Indeed, I will.
Well, I look forward to seeing you then.
Okay. David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check up on the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the February 6th, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.